A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been tapering off Seroquel, an antipsychotic used off-label at low doses for sleep, and the next day, grogginess has been brutal. He's got ADHD. He's found stimulants genuinely helpful, but sleep has always been the hard part. His question is basically, if you've tried the usual sleep drugs, seen a psychiatrist, done the sleep hygiene thing, and nothing's really worked, who do you actually go to? Is sleep medicine a real specialty you can access? Or is it this vague thing everyone talks about, but nobody can actually book an appointment with? And are sleep studies only for people with obvious disorders? Or could they serve as something useful even when you think your sleep is fine?
This is one of those questions where the gap between what exists and what people can actually access is enormous. Daniel's hitting on something I saw constantly in practice. Patients handed Ambien or Trazodone or Seroquel by a primary care doc or psychiatrist, and nobody ever said, maybe we should actually study your sleep before we keep throwing sedatives at it. So yes, sleep medicine is absolutely a real specialty. And no, most people never get anywhere near an actual sleep physician.
The specialty exists, but it's like this walled garden that patients stumble past without knowing there's a door.
The American Academy of Sleep Medicine has been around since 1975. There are over 8,000 board-certified sleep medicine physicians in the U. But here's what most people don't realize. Sleep medicine isn't its own primary residency. It's a subspecialty. You can only become board-certified after completing a residency in something else first. The most common pathways are pulmonology, neurology, psychiatry, internal medicine, and occasionally ENT or family medicine.
The sleep specialist you end up with might have a completely different intellectual framework depending on what they trained in first. A pulmonologist is going to be looking for apnea. A neurologist might be thinking about movement disorders or parasomnias. A psychiatrist is going to be thinking about the anxiety insomnia loop.
And it explains why two different sleep physicians can give the same patient completely different workups. If you walk into a sleep clinic run out of a pulmonary department, the first thing they'll do is screen you for sleep disordered breathing. And to be fair, that's appropriate. Obstructive sleep apnea is wildly underdiagnosed. The Sleep Foundation estimates about 30 million Americans have it, and roughly 80% of moderate to severe cases are undiagnosed. But if apnea isn't your problem, you might get a clean bill of health and still be no closer to solving the insomnia.
Daniel's instinct that a sleep study wouldn't find anything. That's a really common assumption worth poking at. What does a sleep study actually measure that might be useful for someone whose main complaint is just terrible sleep initiation and morning grogginess?
A standard in-lab polysomnogram measures a lot more than most people realize. EEG leads tracking brainwave activity through the night, eye movement sensors for REM detection, chin and leg EMG for muscle tone and periodic limb movements, airflow sensors, respiratory effort belts, oxygen saturation, heart rate, body position. It's a massive data stream, and what that lets you do is see the architecture of someone's sleep, how long it takes to fall asleep, how much time they spend in each stage, how many awakenings they have, and whether they remember them, whether there are breathing events fragmenting their sleep even if they don't meet the clinical threshold for apnea.
Someone like Daniel could have respiratory effort-related arousals that don't qualify as full apneas or hypopneas, but are still yanking him out of deep sleep a dozen times an hour. And he'd have no idea. He'd just wake up feeling like he'd been lightly dozing all night.
REAs, respiratory effort-related arousals. They're part of what the AASM calls the Respiratory Disturbance Index, which is broader than the classic apnea, hypopnea index. Some labs use one, some use the other, and the scoring criteria actually changed in 2012, and there's still not universal agreement. But the point is, you can have a sleep study that shows no sleep apnea by the strict AHI definition, and still have significant sleep fragmentation from subtle breathing issues. Or you might discover periodic limb movement disorder, which a lot of people have no idea they're experiencing because the movements are subtle and they don't fully wake up, but their deep sleep gets shredded.
which would explain the morning feeling like you'd been hit by a truck, even if you technically slept 8 hours.
That's before we even get to the insomnia-specific findings. A sleep study for someone with chronic insomnia often shows paradoxical insomnia, or sleep state misperception, where the EEG shows you're asleep but your subjective experience is that you were awake. Or it shows an absolutely trash sleep architecture where you're getting almost no slow-wave sleep, the deep restorative stage. That by itself can explain next-day cognitive fog.
The sleep study is not just a yes-no test for apnea. It's a window into what's actually happening. But here's the practical question. Daniel's really asking, can you even get one? If you go to your doctor and say, I've had lifelong sleep initiation problems. I've tried Ambien and Seroquel, and they make me groggy. I want to see a sleep specialist. What actually happens?
The pathway exists, but it's a labyrinth. In most health systems, you need a referral. Your primary care physician has to agree that a sleep study or a sleep medicine consult is warranted. And here's where it gets frustrating. A lot of PCPs were trained in an era where insomnia was treated with a prescription pad and some basic sleep hygiene advice. The idea of referring out for cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which is now the first-line treatment according to the American College of Physicians, is still not as embedded in primary care as it should be.
Daniel mentioned he's already seen a psychiatrist. You'd think a psychiatrist would be the one to say, actually, let's get a proper sleep worker before we keep experimenting with off-label antipsychotics.
You would think, and some psychiatrists are excellent about this. But psychiatry has historically had a complicated relationship with sleep medicine. On one hand, sleep disturbance is a diagnostic criterion for everything from major depression to generalized anxiety disorder to PTSD. On the other, the reflex is often to treat the sleep problem as a symptom of the psychiatric condition rather than as a potentially independent disorder that needs its own diagnostic process. So you get the Seroquel prescription, which makes a certain kind of sense. It's sedating, it's not a controlled substance like Ambien, it doesn't have the same dependence concerns, but nobody's actually looked at what's happening during the patient's sleep.
Which brings us to the question of who the actual experts are. Daniel asked, who are the sleep specialists? And is there someone who could coach him on sleep hygiene with real expertise, not just the generic avoid screens before bed advice?
There are really three tiers of expertise here. Tier 1 is the board-certified sleep medicine physician, someone who did a 1-year sleep medicine fellowship after their primary residency and passed the certification exam. These are the people running accredited sleep centers and interpreting polysomnograms. Tier 2 is the behavioral sleep medicine specialist. This is a subset that focuses specifically on psychological and behavioral interventions. They're often psychologists who did additional training in sleep disorders, and they're the ones who really know how to deliver CBTI with fidelity. Tier 3 is what I'd call sleep-adjacent clinicians. Sleep coaches, CBTI-trained therapists who aren't necessarily board-certified in behavioral sleep medicine, dentists who make oral appliances for apnea.
The sleep coaches are a mixed bag.
There's no protected title. Anyone can call themselves a sleep coach. Some are excellent. Former sleep technologists or nurses who worked in sleep labs for years and really know their stuff. Others took a weekend certification course and are essentially selling you a very expensive sleep hygiene handout. The challenge for someone like Daniel is figuring out which is which.
Even if you find the right person, can you actually get in? What's the waiting time like? What does it cost? Does insurance cover any of this?
This is where the accessibility question gets real. Board-certified sleep medicine physicians are in short supply. The AASM has been warning about this for years. The fellowship programs aren't producing enough specialists to meet demand, and a lot of the current workforce is nearing retirement age. A survey a few years back found the average wait time for a new patient appointment at an accredited sleep center was something like 2 to 3 months, and that was pre-pandemic. It's probably longer now in a lot of places.
2 to 3 months when you're already struggling to function is an eternity.
It really is. And that's assuming you're near a major medical center. Rural areas, forget it. You might be looking at a telemedicine consult, which is actually expanding access in some interesting ways. The home sleep apnea test has made it possible to at least screen for apnea without going to a lab, though it's much more limited than an in-lab study. But for insomnia specifically, the really effective intervention, CBTI, doesn't require a sleep lab at all. It can be delivered via telehealth, and there's decent evidence that online CBTI programs work too.
Let's talk about CBTI for a minute, because I think a lot of people hear cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia and think it's just sleep hygiene with a fancier name. What does it actually involve?
It's much more structured and counterintuitive than most people expect. The core components are stimulus control, which means getting out of bed if you're not sleeping and only using the bed for sleep. No lying there for hours with your mind racing. Sleep restriction, which is exactly what it sounds like. You restrict your time in bed to match the amount of sleep you're actually getting, creating a mild sleep debt that builds sleep pressure. Cognitive restructuring around catastrophic beliefs about sleep, and relaxation training. The sleep restriction piece in particular is brutal in the first couple of weeks. You're deliberately spending less time in bed, which feels completely backwards when you're already exhausted.
You're essentially forcing the body's homeostatic sleep drive to build up enough that it overpowers the cognitive hyperarousal that's keeping you awake. It's almost like exposure therapy for the bed.
The data on CBTI is remarkably strong. The American College of Physicians made it the first-line recommendation for chronic insomnia in 2016, ahead of any medication. Multiple meta-analyses show it's as effective as pharmacotherapy in the short term and more durable in the long term. People maintain the gains because they've learned skills rather than relying on a pill. The problem is access. There simply aren't enough trained CBTI providers.
We've got a situation where the most effective treatment for chronic insomnia is a behavioral intervention that doesn't require a sleep lab or a prescription, but the bottleneck is the number of people qualified to deliver it. Meanwhile, the easier-to-access option is medication, which is less durable and comes with side effects like the next-day grogginess Daniel's dealing with.
The medication pathway has its own problems. Let's talk about what Daniel's been on. Seroquel, generic name quetiapine, is an atypical antipsychotic. At full doses, 300 to 800 milligrams, it's used for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. At the low doses used for sleep, typically 25 to 100 milligrams, it's primarily acting as a potent antihistamine at the H1 receptor. It's basically a very expensive, very sedating antihistamine with additional effects on serotonin and dopamine receptors that contribute to the next day hangover.
The sleep it produces is pharmacologically more like being knocked out by Benadryl than actually cycling through natural sleep stages.
That's the concern, and it's one of the reasons sleep medicine specialists tend to cringe at the widespread off-label use of quetiapine for insomnia. There's actually very little high-quality evidence supporting its use for primary insomnia. Most of the studies are in patients with comorbid psychiatric conditions. And the side effect profile is not trivial. Weight gain, metabolic changes, restless legs in some cases, and that profound morning sedation. The half-life of quetiapine is about 6 to 7 hours, but its active metabolite has a half-life of about 12 hours. So if you take it at 10 p.m, you've still got significant drug activity when you're trying to get up at 7 a.m.
Which is exactly the problem Daniel described. The cruise portion of his day is fine, but getting up to cruising altitude is the hard part. The drug is still on board. And Ambien, by contrast, has a much shorter half-life. What? 2 to 3 hours?
About 2.5 hours for the immediate release formulation. So Ambien is designed to get you to sleep quickly and then clear out. The problem with Ambien, or Zolpidem, is that it's a non-benzodiazepine hypnotic that acts on the same GABA, a receptor complex as benzodiazepines, just more selectively. It's effective for sleep onset, but it doesn't do much for sleep maintenance, and it's associated with tolerance, dependence, and some weird side effects, complex sleep-related behaviors like sleepwalking, sleep eating, even sleep driving. The FDA put a black box warning on these drugs for a reason.
Daniel's tried the long-acting sledgehammer and the short-acting hypnotic, and neither gave him what he actually needs, restorative sleep without next-day impairment. What are the newer options he might not have encountered?
This is where the field has actually gotten interesting in the last decade. The dual orexin receptor antagonists, or DORAs, represent a different mechanism. Instead of enhancing GABA activity to sedate the brain, they block orexin, a neuropeptide that promotes wakefulness. It's not a sedative, it's more like removing the wakefulness signal rather than forcing a sleep signal. The first one approved was suvorexant, brand name Belsomra, in 2014. Since then, we've had Leborexant, Davigo, and Daridorexant, Quvigic.
It's the difference between pushing the brake pedal and taking your foot off the accelerator.
That's the analogy, and it's a meaningful distinction. The Doras tend to have less next-day impairment, less potential for abuse, and they don't suppress deep sleep the way GABA-ergic drugs can. There's also a new class emerging, the melatonin receptor agonists, though Ramotine has been around for a while. And something I've been watching closely, drugs that target the circadian system more directly. There's a compound called Tasimelteon, brand name Hetlioz, approved for non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, a circadian rhythm disorder where people's internal clocks drift later and later each day. It's primarily used in blind patients, but the mechanism is fascinating. It's a melatonin receptor agonist that essentially helps entrain the circadian clock.
That connects to something Daniel said about his daily energy arc. Getting up to cruising altitude and landing are the hard parts. That sounds less like classic insomnia and more like a circadian rhythm issue, maybe a delayed sleep phase.
Delayed sleep phase disorder is exactly what came to mind when I read his description. DSPD is a circadian rhythm sleep-wake disorder where your internal clock is shifted later than the social clock. You can't fall asleep until 2 or 3 AA, and if you have to get up at 7 for work, you're fighting your biology every single morning. The grogginess upon waking is profound because your body thinks it's still the middle of the night. But here's the key. If you let someone with DSPD sleep on their natural schedule, say midnight to 8 AM or even later, their sleep quality is actually normal. The problem is the misalignment with societal demands.
Daniel's found stimulants helpful for his ADHD, which makes sense. They're helping with daytime executive function. But they might also be masking the sleep deprivation from a circadian misalignment. He's medicating the downstream consequence rather than the root cause.
That's a really important point. Stimulants can absolutely improve daytime functioning in someone who's sleep-deprived, but they're not fixing the sleep. And if you have both ADHD and a circadian rhythm disorder, which co-occur at higher rates than you'd expect by chance, you're in this complex situation where the treatments for one condition can affect the other. Stimulants can make sleep initiation harder if they're still active in the evening. Sleep deprivation worsens ADHD symptoms. It's a feedback loop.
If Daniel were to actually get in front of a good sleep medicine physician, what would that workup look like? Walk me through it.
A thorough sleep medicine consult starts with a detailed history that goes way beyond how many hours do you sleep. They'll want to know about sleep timing. When do you go to bed? When do you actually fall asleep? When do you wake up, and how does that shift on weekends versus weekdays? They'll ask about the sleep environment, pre-bed routines, caffeine and alcohol intake, exercise timing. They'll screen for restless legs, for sleep apnea symptoms like snoring or witnessed apneas, for parasomnias, for daytime sleepiness using something like the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. They'll want a complete medication history, including over-the-counter stuff and supplements. They'll ask about mood, anxiety, trauma history, and then they'll decide whether a sleep study is indicated.
For someone like Daniel, where the primary complaint is sleep initiation difficulty in morning grogginess without obvious apnea symptoms, would they order a study or go straight to a clinical diagnosis?
It depends on the physician and the specific presentation, but a reasonable approach might be to do a 1 to 2 week actigraphy study first. Actigraphy is basically a wrist-worn accelerometer, like a research-grade Fitbit, that tracks movement patterns to estimate sleep and wake. It's not as detailed as a polysomnogram, but it gives you objective data about sleep timing, duration, and variability over multiple nights in the person's home environment. If the actigraphy suggests delayed sleep phase or irregular sleep-wake patterns, that might be enough for a diagnosis without a full in-lab study.
If the actigraphy doesn't give clear answers,
then an in-lab polysomnogram might be warranted, possibly with a multiple sleep latency test the following day, if there's concern about narcolepsy or idiopathic hypersomnia. The MSLT is a series of nap opportunities throughout the day where they measure how quickly you fall asleep and whether you enter REM. It's the gold standard for diagnosing narcolepsy, but it's also useful for quantifying objective daytime sleepiness.
There's actually a pretty robust diagnostic pathway available. The question is whether someone like Daniel, who's already been through the ringer with psychiatry and medication trials, can get anyone to take him down that pathway, rather than just offering another prescription.
This is where I think patients need to be equipped to advocate for themselves. If you've been on multiple sleep medications without satisfactory results, that's a clear indication for a sleep medicine referral. The AASM's clinical practice guidelines are explicit about this. Pharmacotherapy should not be the indefinite default for chronic insomnia without a proper diagnostic evaluation, but patients often don't know to ask, and physicians often don't think to refer.
What about the cost side? If Daniel wants to pursue this, is he looking at thousands of dollars out of pocket, or does insurance typically cover sleep studies and CBTI?
It varies enormously by insurance plan and by country. Daniel's in Israel, so the system is different from the U. In the U, in-lab polysomnograms typically run between $1,000 and $3,000 before insurance, and most plans will cover them if there's documented medical necessity. Home sleep apnea tests are much cheaper, a few hundred dollars. CBTI is trickier. Some plans cover it, especially if delivered by a licensed psychologist, but many don't. And the out-of-pocket cost for a full course of CBTI, typically 6 to 8 sessions, can be anywhere from $500 to $1,500. In Israel, the system is more centralized. The health funds, the Kupot Cholim, do have sleep clinics, but wait times can be long, and not all of them have robust behavioral sleep medicine services.
There's a practical question of how to navigate this. If you're Daniel and you've decided you want to actually get to the bottom of this, what's the concrete sequence of steps?
Step one is recognizing that what you've been doing isn't working and that there's a whole field of specialists you haven't tapped into. Step two is going to your primary care physician or psychiatrist and saying, I've tried multiple medications with limited success and significant side effects. I'd like a referral to a sleep medicine physician for a comprehensive evaluation. If they push back, you can cite the ACP guidelines recommending behavioral interventions as first-line treatment. Step three is the consult itself. Go in with a sleep diary, at least 2 weeks of data, and be specific about your complaints. Step four is following through on whatever diagnostic testing is recommended, whether that's actigraphy, a home sleep test, or an in-lab study. And step five is actually engaging with the treatment, whether that's CBTI, a circadian rhythm intervention like timed light therapy and melatonin, or targeted pharmacotherapy based on the actual diagnosis.
The sleep diary point is underrated. Most people show up to a doctor and say, I don't sleep well without any data. 2 weeks of logging when you went to bed, when you think you fell asleep, when you woke up, how you felt in the morning. That's gold for a sleep physician.
It really is. And it's something anyone can start doing tomorrow morning without a referral or a copay. I'd add that if you have a partner, ask them what they observe, snoring, gasping, leg movements, talking in your sleep. A lot of sleep disorders are more apparent to the bed partner than to the patient.
Let me push on something. Daniel said, I always thought my sleep is fine, nothing would be discovered by having a sleep study. That's a really common sentiment, and I think it comes from this idea that sleep studies are only for people who stop breathing at night or have dramatic parasomnias. What percentage of people who go for a sleep study for insomnia actually end up with a finding that changes their management?
I don't have an exact number, but anecdotally, it's substantial. A study published in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine a few years back looked at patients referred for chronic insomnia and found that something like 25 to 30% had undiagnosed sleep disorder breathing on polysomnography and about 15% had periodic limb movement disorder. So you're looking at maybe 40% of insomnia patients having an occult organic sleep disorder that wasn't apparent from the history alone. That's not trivial.
40% is way higher than I think most people would guess. So Daniel's assumption, my sleep is fine, I just can't get to it, might be wrong in ways that are actually detectable.
Even if the study is completely normal, that's useful information too. It rules out a bunch of things and points more confidently toward a behavioral or circadian explanation. It gives you a clearer target.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the home sleep apnea test versus the in-lab study. Daniel's in Jerusalem. If he gets referred for a sleep study, what's he likely to encounter, and what are the limitations of the home test he should know about?
The home sleep apnea test, or HSAT, has become much more common, especially since the pandemic pushed everything toward home-based care. It's convenient, it's cheaper, and for straightforward obstructive sleep apnea in a high-risk patient, it's perfectly adequate. But the HSAT has significant limitations. It typically doesn't measure sleep stages because there's no EEG. It doesn't detect non-respiratory sleep disorders at all. No periodic limb movement data, no parasomnia characterization, no seizure detection. and it tends to underestimate the severity of sleep apnea because it measures total recording time rather than total sleep time. If you're lying in bed awake for 2 hours, the HSAT averages your breathing events over the whole recording period, which dilutes the index.
If you have a mix of insomnia and mild apnea, the home test might miss the apnea entirely because you weren't actually asleep for enough of the recording.
And that's a really common scenario. The overlap between insomnia and sleep apnea is well documented. There's even a term for it, comorbid insomnia and sleep apnea, COMISA. Studies suggest something like 30 to 40% of people with sleep apnea also have insomnia and vice versa. If you only screen for apnea with a home test and miss the insomnia component, or only treat the insomnia and miss the apnea, you're not going to get great results.
Which brings us back to the value of an in-lab study and a physician who's thinking about the whole picture. Let me ask you something from Daniel's perspective. He's been dealing with this his whole life. He's tried medications. He's done sleep hygiene. At what point does someone accept that this is just how they're wired versus continuing to chase a solution?
That's a really good and really difficult question. I think the answer depends on the degree of impairment. If your sleep is suboptimal but you're functioning, your relationships are okay, your work isn't suffering, and you're not miserable. Maybe you decide the juice isn't worth the squeeze and you focus on coping strategies rather than a cure. But Daniel's description suggests significant impairment. The morning grogginess that lasts well into the day, the lifelong struggle, the fact that he's seeking out stimulants to function, that's not a minor inconvenience. That's a quality of life issue that warrants a proper workup.
The stimulants add an interesting wrinkle. If he's on ADHD medication, that's improving his daytime function, but it might also be masking how bad his sleep actually is. He might be functioning better than he would unmedicated, but still well below what he'd be capable of with restorative sleep.
That's the trap. Stimulants can create a false sense of adequacy. You're getting through the day, you're productive, so you think the sleep problem can't be that bad. But you're essentially borrowing against your body's reserves, and that's not sustainable indefinitely. There's also the question of whether the ADHD diagnosis itself might be partly a consequence of chronic sleep deprivation. The symptoms overlap significantly. Inattention, executive dysfunction, emotional dysregulation. There are cases where treating an underlying sleep disorder dramatically improves what looked like ADHD.
That's a provocative thought. How often does that actually happen?
It's hard to put a number on it, but there's a well-known phenomenon in sleep medicine where children diagnosed with ADHD turn out to have sleep-disordered breathing, and after a denatonsillectomy, their attention and behavior normalize. In adults, the picture is more complex, but I've seen cases where treating severe sleep apnea reduced ADHD-like symptoms to the point where stimulants were no longer needed. I'm not suggesting that's Daniel's situation. He has a long-standing ADHD diagnosis and finds stimulants helpful. But it's worth considering whether optimizing his sleep might change his medication needs or his symptom profile.
We've covered the diagnostic pathway, the specialist landscape, the medication options, the behavioral interventions. Let me try to synthesize this into something actionable for someone in Daniel's position. You've tried the medication route. It's been a mixed bag at best. You suspect there might be a circadian component. You want to get to someone who actually knows what they're doing. The playbook is, get a referral to a board-certified sleep medicine physician, ideally one with a behavioral sleep medicine program attached. Go in with 2 weeks of sleep diary data. Be open to a sleep study, even if you think your sleep is structurally fine. If CBTI is recommended, do it properly. The sleep restriction part is going to suck, but the data say it works. And if there's a circadian rhythm disorder, timed melatonin and light therapy are low-risk, evidence-based interventions that a sleep specialist can guide you through.
That's a solid summary. I'd add one thing. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. If you can't get in to see a sleep medicine physician for 3 months, start with what's available. There are good online CBTI programs, Sleepio, Shooty, now called Summarist, that have randomized controlled trial data behind them. They're not as good as in-person CBTI with a skilled therapist, but they're much better than another year of suffering while you wait for an appointment.
If you're in Israel, the health fund system does have sleep medicine services, but you may need to be persistent. The Kupa might have a sleep clinic in a major city that your local clinic doesn't routinely refer to. Sometimes, it's just a matter of knowing what to ask for.
That's true in pretty much every health system. The squeaky wheel gets the sleep study. actually being able to say, I've read the ACP guidelines, I know CBTI is the first line recommendation, I'd like to explore that. That changes the conversation with your doctor from, I can't sleep, give me something, to, I've done my homework and I want evidence-based care.
One more thing I want to touch on. Daniel mentioned the idea of someone who could coach him on sleep hygiene with real expertise, not just the generic advice. Is there a role for that kind of coaching, assuming you can find someone legitimate?
The best sleep coaches or sleep therapists are essentially delivering a structured behavioral program with accountability. They're checking your sleep diary, adjusting your sleep window week by week, helping you troubleshoot when you hit a wall, reinforcing stimulus control when you want to give up and scroll in bed. That kind of support can be really valuable, especially for someone who's been struggling for years and has developed a lot of anxiety around sleep. The key is finding someone who's actually trained in CBTI or behavioral sleep medicine, not just someone who calls themselves a sleep coach and tells you to buy blackout curtains.
How do you vet that? What credentials should someone look for?
In the U, the gold standard for behavioral sleep medicine is the Diplomate in Behavioral Sleep Medicine, or DBSM, a certification from the Board of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. There's also a certification from the AASM for CBTI providers. In other countries, it varies. But a good rule of thumb is to ask directly, what specific training have you had in CBTI, and are you following a manualized protocol? If they can't answer that clearly, keep looking. A real CBTI provider should be able to tell you exactly what the treatment involves, sleep restriction, stimulus control, cognitive restructuring, and what the expected time course is.
There is a real specialty here, with real experts, real diagnostic tools, and real treatments that go way beyond try this pill or avoid caffeine after noon. The problem is that the system doesn't root people there efficiently. You have to know it exists and push for it.
That's the tragedy of sleep medicine. The science is robust, the clinical practice guidelines are clear, the treatments work. But the average person with chronic insomnia is still getting Ambien from their PCP or Seroquel from their psychiatrist, and nobody's doing actigraphy or offering CBTI or considering a circadian rhythm disorder. The specialty exists, but it's hidden behind a referral process that most patients don't know how to navigate.
That's why Daniel's question is so good. He's essentially asking, does this hidden world of sleep expertise actually exist, and can someone like me get in the door? The answer to both is yes, but it takes more effort than it should. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The collective noun for a group of porcupines is a prickle.
Where does this leave us? I think the forward-looking thought here is that sleep medicine is at an inflection point. The evidence for behavioral interventions is overwhelming. The limitations of long-term pharmacotherapy are well documented. The diagnostic tools are getting more accessible with home-based testing and telemedicine. But the bottleneck remains the number of trained specialists and the awareness gap in primary care. If you're struggling with sleep and the usual approaches haven't worked, the expertise is out there. You just might have to be the one who insists on accessing it.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.